Each animal born or brought to the facility is given a digital tag after a lab examination. This company's advanced veterinary and genetic lab complex carries out essential functions. It's worth mentioning that one of its labs is mainly dedicated to testing cows and their milk. Here, milk is tested for its microbial load. This usually involves a standard plate count, which determines the total number of bacteria in a sample. These results are then used to determine the grade of milk. It might be interesting to know that this company has received numerous awards for being the best model cattle breeder in the province and the country. These titles were granted based on meeting nearly 40 standards of the Ministry of Agriculture. Such achievements were made possible by dozens of expert staff employed at this company. Its other laboratory is dedicated to raising sheep. At this facility, sheep are genetically selected for specific characteristics. They are also genetically bred to produce twins and sometimes triplets. This company has never stopped eyeing the future. It plans to expand its facilities further while incorporating new technology and applying the latest science to increase the quality of its products. In 2019 was considered the golden period for red meat production in the country. Since then, production has grown each year, primarily because of the removal of an export ban. 3 years ago, Iran imported large amounts of meat to supply domestic needs, while domestic meat production was operating at full capacity. The ban was implemented to stabilize the market and support local production. Iran's Livestock Exporters National Assembly estimates domestic needs for red meat at around 60 million heads of light livestock annually. Last year, this number was 72 million, which is well above average. This meant 12 million light livestock were ready for culling and exports. The Ministry of Agriculture puts red meat's domestic per capita consumption at over 12 kilograms, with lamb being the most popular red meat. This year, the National Statistical Center, or SCI, reported red meat production stood at nearly 51,000 tons in the month of May alone. Based on the SCI figures, over 1.3 million livestock holding farms are spread across the country. 54% of these farm small livestock and 26% are dedicated to large livestock husbandry. The remaining 20% farms both large and small livestock. The meat industry in Iran is worth some $2 billion. But not all livestock are raised for meat. They are also reared for their milk. Based on the SCI, Iran annually produces nearly 9 million tons of raw milk. 70% of this amount is produced on industrial farms, and the rest comes from traditional dairy farms. Going off of figures from Iran's Customs Administration, on average, roughly 800,000 tons of raw milk are exported annually, valued at around $800 million. All things considered, Iran's livestock industry is booming and is an excellent place for investors who will see quick returns and profit. Now it's that time of the show for me to step aside for several minutes because my good friend and colleague has another awesome field report lined up for you. Take it away.
The basis of the steel industry is iron ore. It's courtesy of this critical raw material that steel is all around us. In the beneficiation process, the gangue minerals, or the mineral matter of no value that occurs with the metallic ore, is removed from the mineral substance and iron ore concentrate is produced. The concentrate is then shipped from mining plants as a bulk commodity by rail.
Hi again. The wagons carrying the iron ore concentrate have reached their destination. What happens at this stage is that through a gargantuan machine, they are overturned. This is called a wagon tippler. What it does is that it tips the wagons. It retains the wagons from the top and it overturns them. First, the wagons are detached from other wagons, and then they're lifted over here. And look at those arms. Look at those arms, how gigantic they are. And now they're going to retain the wagon, overturn it to empty its load into a container. From that container, the iron ore concentrate is going to be mixed. First, it's going to travel through some distance, and it's going to be mixed with some additives to be fed into the pelletizing process.
In this week's feature program, we visited Chotormalu Industrial Facility, located in the center of Iran, Yazd Province. The iron ore concentrate must be pelletized for use in iron and steel making. In summary, pelletizing is achieved by combining the iron ore with water and a specific binder, which is then rolled up in a balling drum to produce relatively uniform pellets, which can then be easily handled in downstream processes.
And here we are. The powder is the iron ore concentrate now mixed with some additive. It is now fed into large discs. In this industrial complex, everything is just enormous. This is called the pelleting disc. It's really huge. Now what happens here is, through the use of centrifugal force, the powder gets compressed and it's just pushed to the edges of this disc. And after the powder completes a couple rotation, and as it grows in size, then it forms the pellets. And once it is just large enough, it will exit the rotation because of that centrifugal force, and it moves over to the conveyor belt, and it's now time for grading. Now, those particles that are just perfect in size and shape, they will move on to travel over to the kiln, where the content moisture is removed and sintering takes place. So the iron pellet now gets hardened, and after that, cooling takes place. Now, stay with us for more.
Chotormalu's pelletizing plant, with a production capacity of 3.4 million tons per year, employs 500 people directly and another 3,000 indirectly. The iron ore pellets will be transferred to stackers and are piled in an area which can store 300,000 tons of pellets.
Fe2O3, I don't know how familiar you are with chemistry and the chemical reactions and the periodic table, but anyway, at this stage of the process, Fe2O3 is going to be turned into Fe through a process that is called direct reduction of iron. And this process is done by three main stages. The first stage occurs above furnace. The pellets are poured into the furnace. And what happens inside the furnace is two gases are going to hit the pellets. The gases are carbon monoxide and molecular hydrogen. They're extracted from natural gas through a process that is called reformation. And two gases are going to hit the pellets, and through three chemical reactions, Fe2O3 is going to turn into Fe, which is called the reduced iron, or also sponge iron because of its high porosity. Now, this process can be done in two different ways. One is called hot direct reduction of iron, and the other one is called cold direct reduction of iron. Now, I'm going to move on to the next and the final stage, steel production.
Hot direct reduced iron, or HDRI, is DRI that is transported hot directly from the reduction furnace into an electric arc furnace, thereby saving energy. Whereas cold DRI is the one that is cooled and stored before being charged to a furnace. Well, on the face of it, there's no reason for facilities to even consider cold DRI, but in reality, it's not really that simple. The development of mankind would have been impossible but for steel. It fueled the Industrial Revolution and remains the backbone of modern industrialized economies. The process continues with primary steelmaking, which is done via electric arc furnace at Chotormalu, and then moves on to secondary steelmaking, which involves treating, continuous casting, and shaping.
The final product is made, the steel billet, and you can tell how hot it is in here. Well, the process here starts with the electric arc furnace. It melts the sponge iron that I talked about earlier. And what happens next is that we need some ladles. Ladles are containers. They're going to contain the molten material. Then the ladles are taken over some molds. Molds are going to carry the molten material And as the molten material is carried over some distance, it solidifies into the final product, which is this steel billet. Now, this complex is really huge. Everything inside it is gigantic. And I've been with you from the very beginning of this process, the iron concentrate, to the very end.
Thanks for that educational adventure once again. Well, that covers our show for today. I have been Samson Seas. Sees you in the next bazaar.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Ladies' Favorite Program, Muslim Lady. Well, once more, I'm here as your host. I'm Asma, at your service. And today, we have Brother Mustafa with us as the guest. Assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome.
Alaikum assalam. Thank you for having me. Yes, I'm Mustafa, and I'm also a student here. I am researching psychology and Islamic studies here.
So that's very great. Thank you for being here. As the ritual of this program goes, we usually have another lady to help us, but this time now it's just like looking from the other side of the story.
Yeah.
Because it's always us talking about us. Now let's another...
I think we're all human beings, right?
Exactly.
And if you had a lady speaking about men, I don't think anyone would really even object to that.
Exactly.
Right? And of course, when we're studying psychology, you know, this is a big topic, you know, our role as, what roles we play as fathers, as mothers, as genders. So it's definitely a good topic to speak about.
Exactly. Yeah. We've been talking about women and how Islam is looking at them and how the duty, the roles of mothers or the roles of women as mothers has been weaker and weaker by time in this modern life. Now we come to this point that we know that already a woman as a person who's going to be the mother of a child has got some responsibilities. And these responsibilities are not just limited to the time when she is expecting a child. No, even before that, she has got some responsibilities. The duty of a woman before even giving birth to a child.
Right. That's a great question, you know. The reason why we need to know these things is because I didn't realize this, you know, maybe when I was younger, but... you know, we know this, that when we marry and we have children, you know, the genes of like the father and the mother, they're both get combined, right?
Yeah.
So the child gets both traits of the mother and the father.
He or she is actually the mixture of both.
Right. So your genes, right, are being developed as like I'm speaking right now.
Mm-hmm.
As I'm speaking, as I'm doing day-to-day things, it has an impact on our genetics and our traits. And so even before you're even married or even before, you know, you're going to have a child, your lifestyle is going to affect your personality and traits.
Precisely.
And that's going to affect, like, your children.
Yeah.
So even before, like, you have a child, so it's important that you have a decent and balanced lifestyle, right? You have
exactly.
a good lifestyle.
Yeah, this is the core of what we're talking about.
Yeah, I know. The reason I bring that up is because I don't think people always realize how important that is.
Yeah.
Right? That genetics play a huge role. Did you know that, for example, that color blindness, you know, is much more prevalent in men than in women? So a woman may have, for example, those genes for color blindness, but they don't get activated. Whereas in men, they do get activated. And there's actually like a whole genetic reason behind this.
Yeah.
So it's like, there's so many other studies that have been done which show, you know, the effect. So that's why I'm bringing it up, that it's not just like when you're about to have a child that you need to start thinking about, hey, what I should be doing. It's like a lifelong journey even to that point.
Yeah, that's very true. So, yes, in order to be the perfect mother or perfect father, we have to take care of the time that we have been all alone. Right. So even we have it in the quotes and in the sayings that something like this, a bad tree does not give good apples, something like that, I suppose. Okay. Like if you are not, if you do not have a good structure yourself, you are not going to expect a good structure coming out of you. So you have to take care of your own self in order to bringing about something good, to have a fruitful outcome. So let's go for a short break and then we'll be back. Thank you for staying with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
So speaking to lead a decent life and to live a perfect, healthy life before getting to be a mother, how we should do that?
Yeah, and of course, I'm not a mother, but I get to answer this question
just
today.
As a psychologist, expert in psychology.
Yes.
And does it differ from the Western perspective and the Islamic perspective?
So some things, by the way, are cultural, right? For example, in certain cultures, you'll have like a mother should eat this, before they get pregnant, they should be doing this or eating that. So some things are cultural. Definitely within Islam, we have advices on, type of things and type of things we should be eating or doing. So it differs, yes, it definitely differs a little bit. However, there's many things which I think are just based on common sense and logic, right?
Yeah.
They're sort of unique and they're universal. Some of the practical things that I would suggest someone to do, for example, in this sort of arena would definitely be to educate themselves, right? You're going to listen to this episode for maybe, I don't know, whatever it is, 10 to 15 minutes, and that's definitely not enough. I would say if you're going to become a parent, and whether you're a father even, I would say you need to go and read and learn. Like one of the things that's talked about today in psychology, about parenting is that today parenting comes with suffering. It comes with you having to sort of go through a lot of troubles.
Exactly.
And trials and tribulations.
But that's the way of life for everything.
It is, but it's much, much more serious when it comes to parenting.
Yeah,
right?
It would be intensified.
Yeah, and if you don't know, like if you don't have the right knowledge or the mm-hmm. skill set, to be in that position, then you're harming your child. You're yeah. harming their life.
Next
right?
generation.
Yeah, yeah. So it's really important, I would say, that for all parents these days,
yeah.
is to learn. Now, that includes, for example, a mother, for example, to know what are the physical requirements needed. For example, one of the things that we see, unfortunately, today is a lot of women don't exercise. Right?
Yeah.
Now, you might think that's something very simple, but it's really important for someone who's going to become a mother. Is your physical
yeah.
strength, is your physical capabilities, is your physical, health is completely and totally linked to your abilities to be a mother, right?
Exactly.
So it's not just about like knowing, for example, psychological skills or techniques for children. It's actually knowing about physical health and how to take care of yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would say you mentioned an important thing, which is education. I would say that even if at a school, they start to teach children about their duties in the future as mothers or fathers, it would be pretty much easier for them to come up with the main purpose of their existence, like to be a mother and to breed about some great, respectful generations, like to teach them how to be a perfect mother. What is it? The role of mother. Why is that important?
Yeah. What's interesting is that I visited a university a long time ago in the United States. And in the university, on one of their buildings, they have a statement from Andrew Carnegie, which he actually built like this institute, this university, right? And one of the things that this institute used to do is to train mothers. They used to train them in like cooking and like sewing skills and like
yeah.
motherly skills. Okay.
Yeah.
This was America like 100 years ago where they were teaching women how to be a good mother and they were teaching them those skills. So
that would have been nice if we had it even right now.
Of course. Of course we had something like that. It would be great. But unfortunately, we don't have that, right?
Yeah.
So we don't live in an ideal world. So that's what I'm saying, that you, as a woman that's like going to be living in this world today, in a modern world where you're being attacked from every side, and, you know, there's psychological warfare being done on you, you need to educate yourself. If you don't, then you will cause yourself harm and your family.
Exactly. That is very true. So yeah. Let's go for a short break, refresh our mind, have a sip of water, and then we'll be back. Welcome back, dear ladies. We're talking about you and how to be prepared to be a perfect mother. We were talking about the fact that it could have been good if we had such a course at universities or at a school to teach children about their roles, the most important part of their roles as being mothers or fathers. And now, since we're talking about women as being perfect mothers, how to teach them to have an understanding of their children, to devote time for them, to take care of them, how to do our role in the best, perfect way possible.
Right. So one of the things that we've mentioned in previous episodes is that, you know, psychology deals with how we perceive a human being, right?
Yeah.
So it's really important for us to understand that a man or a woman, you know, how do we perceive them? For example, not only just as a man or a woman, but also I would say, for example, from the angle of their needs, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do I mean by that? So, for example, a 7-year-old child, you know, is different from a 40-year-old person, right?
Exactly.
The need of a 7-year-old differ from the need of a 14-year-old.
And their perception of life is different from that 14-year-old.
Right. So if you're preparing yourself to become, you know, a mother in the future, then you need to understand, like, where you are right now and what are your current needs, for example, mm-hmm. right?
So first answer your identical question, be at peace with yourself, come to terms with your own self, and then start thinking about having
definitely.
A child.
For example, if you started perceiving your role in this world as someone, let's say, that you have to, for example, you know, become the CEO of a company, right? I used to work at a university and I would like interview students.
Mm-hmm.
And many times I would interview, you know, girls that's what their dream was, right? Their dream was to become like the CEO of some company or whatever, right? Now, and, you know, of course, these people will have families in the future, right? They're going to be doing that. But how much does that align with, for example, that person's current needs? How much does that align with their sort of physical abilities? One of the issues we know in today's society is that people are getting married late and then they're having children really late, right?
Yeah.
So that's definitely going to cause harm, because I feel that's going against natural law. That's going against nature.
Yeah, we're breaking the laws of nature, actually.
Yeah, and even a psychologist would agree with that. You know, so many different psychologists have created sort of like a developmental table of a human being, like a human being between the ages of 0 to 7 is like this, between the ages of, you know, 10 to 19. But it's psychology, why are we studying it, you know, in the Hawza? Why are we doing it as part of Islamic studies? Sometimes people sort of criticize us for that, you know. Why are you studying like psychology here? It's like Western psychology. Well, the reason why we're studying it is because if we don't, right, the enemy will use it against us.
Exactly.
And these aren't my words. These are the words of Ayatollah Misbah-Yazdi, who brought psychology as a field of study.
Exactly.
Anyway, I know we're getting off topic, but the whole point here is that if you're going to prepare yourself to be a mother, prepare yourself early. Prepare yourself as much as you can. Educate yourself as much as you can.
Yeah,
you know?
That's very
It doesn't
important.
Even have to be for a mother. Whatever role you're going to play, know yourself and why you're going to be doing that.
The question of identity and what a human being you would like yourself to be is an important thing that you have to answer at an early age. Because if you don't, then when you get older, things are going to get so perplexing and complicated.
Right. And once you're older, you also sort of miss the sort of opportunity to prepare for that moment, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Someone who's sort of been like, I would say from a medical perspective, whatever perspective you want to call it, for example, exercise is so important, right?
Yeah.
Now, if someone doesn't exercise, let's say, and now they're in their 20s, they're definitely going to suffer if they're going to, like, want to start a family, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
So the more you do from a younger age, the better it will be for you. You know, we all know that.
Definitely. Yeah, of course. That's very true. So we were just talking about how to get prepared for the most important role, and that is to be a mother, which, of course, we already talked about why we respect this role, because this is the most fundamental thing a woman can share to her society as a human being. The most important part is to gain knowledge and information about this entity that you're going to create, that you're going to bring into society. And then the most important part is to know yourself, to come to terms with your own self, and then think about bringing up another creature into this world. Thank you for staying with us. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear brothers and sisters, and to all of our listeners out there. This is your host, Sayyid Mustafa, and you're listening to Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. In the show, we discuss different aspects from our source book, Mafatihul Hayat, written by Ayatollah Javad Amini. And the book basically is about how we should be living our lives, the social aspects of our lives. And the book is incredibly specific about many things. The topic that I'll be discussing with you today is an extremely important topic, I would say, probably one of the most important topics that we could potentially discuss, and that is the rights of our believing brothers and sisters, right? The rights of those people who share our faith. We live in a society, and of course, living in a society, we interact with people. It's a given. And Islam places great, great importance on how we interact with people, on the smallest interactions that we have. One thing that should be clarified is there really a difference between our brothers in faith and those who are polytheists, those who are disbelievers? And we have many verses and hadiths which point in this direction. If we look at the Quran, and for example, if we look at verse 18 of Surah Sajda, in this, Allah says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, أَفَمَنْ كَانَ مُؤْمِنًا كَمَنْ كَانَ فَاسِقًا لَا يَسْتَوُونَ, that a believer and a disbeliever, they are not alike, right? They are different. Or somewhere else in the Quran, in Surah Hujurat, in verse 10, God says, إِنَّمَا الْمُؤْمِنُونَ إِخْوَةً, that the believers are brothers of each other. Similarly, there's other verses as well which point in this direction. In another hadith, for example, Imam Ali was asked, please tell us about our believing brothers? You know, how, what are they like, for example? And in this hadith, Imam Ali said that there are two type of believers, those that you can trust and those that you can't trust. So we're not just saying that we're only looking at believers and disbelievers, but we're also looking at believers. And here Imam Ali said that, you know, those believers that you can trust, they're really rare. And you should really, you know, try to be with those people and take care of them. But those that you can't trust, you know, there are going to be a lot of those people out there. And what you want to do with those people is still be nice to them. You know, even if they're pretending to be nice to you, you still want to be nice with them in society. So that was a little bit of discussion about the fact that, you know, there is this difference of view of how we look at a believer and a disbeliever. And before we actually jump into even more practical discussion, there's also this, we have to understand that we actually share something with our brothers in faith, right? We all share the same benchmark, the same standard. We all share our belief in God, the Prophet, and the Ahlul Bayt, and this is what we are rallying around. I would like to continue this discussion right after the break.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
So, dear brothers and sisters, you are listening to The Keys of Life, and we're discussing the rights of our brothers in faith. And the need for this is extremely important, right? Because the need for unity around the things that we believe in, we should be united. And in this regard, we also have many sayings from the Prophet and, you know, verses of the Quran which say, do not disunite. You know, your hearts should be united. God will protect you. He will unite your hearts. Apart from this, I think it's, you know, it's easy to understand that we're human beings. We require social interaction. We have social needs. This is something that we understand maybe on, you know, on an inner level. And also now, even from a psychological point of view, we all understand the need of socializing. We have to also understand that Islam is not just an individualistic religion, right? Islam is a very sort of societal, it's a religion where we're recommended to meet up in the mosque, you know, we're recommended to invite each other to our homes. We're always supposed to be involved in each other's lives. However, this involvement has to be dictated by certain rules and principles. And those are the rules and principles that we want to really get into. The other thing I want to point out is that, you know, people are attracted to societies where the rights of people and justice is upheld, right? Those are the societies that we're all attracted to. Those are the type of societies that we want to live in. However, this can only really be done if we too are practicing those rights, if we too are upholding justice in society. It cannot be done, you know, if we can't really expect this from others and not really do this ourselves. So it's important to learn what those rights are, and Islam places such importance on this topic that we really need to learn about it. So with this regards, some of the hadiths that we find from the Prophet, some of the narrations, for example, it says that, you know, a believer's hands and tongue, they protect another Muslim. You know, a Muslim should not do treason against another Muslim. And then, you know, it goes on to talk about the rewards of this behavior, the rewards that come from helping others. Another hadith which points to this says that if a believer goes to sleep and in their heart they have a grudge, they have negative feelings towards another brother or sister, then their sleeping and waking become a cause of God's wrath and anger. And God's wrath and anger doesn't go away until they ask for forgiveness. We're told we shouldn't cause any harm towards another believer, we shouldn't lie, we shouldn't break our promises. So all of these things tell us how important these interactions can become. Now, some of the benefits that come out of this, right? There are many, many benefits. One of the benefits that we're told about, which I found interesting, is that if we help each other, if we uphold these rights for each other, then we become mustajab ad-dua, which means that God starts accepting our prayers. And, you know, when I read this part in the book, it really reminded me of a story that my dad used to tell me about this person that lived in their neighborhood. People from pretty much, you know, all across town from different cities would come to this person to have him pray for them, because when he would pray, his prayers would be accepted. And my dad said, you know, what made this person so unique, right? One thing was that this person was extremely honest. This person would never refuse to help anyone. Anyone that would come to his door, he would, for example, help them in any way that he could, whether that would be financially, whether that would be with food. The other thing that this person did for the city, he had built 3 schools in the city, and he was helping educate some of the poorest kids off that city. That's all the time we have for today's episode. In coming episodes, we'll be discussing some more practical tips on how we should be interacting in society. Thank you so much for listening. Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There Was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time.
Al-Aqsa Storm Aftermath. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. October 7th, 2023 was a turning point in the history of the West Asian region, and it will remain forever. On that day, the combatants of the Palestinian Hamas movement launched a surprise attack against the Zionist regime and imposed the biggest defeat on the regime since its illegitimate birth 75 years ago. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, dubbed the defeat as an irreparable defeat. Dear listeners, we are going to review the issue in a special series with a focus on the Al-Aqsa Storm and its consequences. Stay tuned for another part, please. leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in a recent speech called the United States as a partner of the Zionist regime in the latter's crimes against the Palestinian people, saying, "In this event, the U.S. is the definitive partner of criminals. I mean, the U.S. hands are plunged in the blood of the innocent, the children, patients, women, and so on. As a matter of fact, it is somehow administering these crimes that are being committed in Gaza. It is the U.S. which is administering." Analysts, lawyers, officials from various countries and global institutions have announced that the Zionist regime is arbitrarily and knowingly doing genocide in Gaza. Yet, it is a matter of astonishment that no serious reaction in an international level has been done against this brutal regime. The main reason for this is that most of the international organizations and their affiliated bodies are under the diabolical dominance of the great Satan, the U.S. The United States and its allies in Europe have always repeated the threadbare lie of legitimate defense to explain the Israeli crimes against Palestinians. Article 51 of the UN Charter emphasizes the right to legitimate defense. It reads, "Nothing in the present charter shall impair the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs against a member of the United Nations, until the Security Council has taken measures necessary to maintain international peace and security. Measures taken by members in the exercise of this right of self-defense shall be immediately reported to the Security Council and shall not in any way affect the authority and responsibility of the Security Council under the present charter to take at any time such action as it deems necessary in order to maintain or restore international peace and security." Americans, according to this article of the UN Charter, claim that the Zionist regime has the right of self-defense after October operation of Hamas. According to the U.S. interpretation of the UN articles, the flagrant genocide of the people of Gaza by Israel is called the right to self-defense. Thus, from the first hours of the recent war in Gaza, Washington entered the scene as the full supporter of the Zionist regime rather than a mediator and a neutral onlooker. Now, a few points should be clarified here. First of all, the Zionist regime is not a country to have the right to defend itself. It is an occupying regime which has usurped the Palestinian territories for over 75 years. Secondly, the attack of Hamas on October 7th was a natural response to 75 years of savagery, massacre, destruction, genocide, and every kind of crime committed by the fabricated regime. Even the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, mentioned this when he said that there were reasons behind Hamas attacks. The fact is that after regaining of power by Benjamin Netanyahu and his highly extremist cabinet in the beginning of 2023, a new wave of violence and unbridled savagery started against Palestinians, so that the number of Palestinian martyrs during the 7 months of this year was more than the whole 2022 year. In view of this, what Hamas did was the right of self-defense. However, in a repeated scenario, the United States has vetoed the UNSC resolution for stopping massacre of Palestinians and a starting of sending humanitarian aids to Gaza. Thus, the U.S. has vetoed over 50 UNSC resolutions against the Zionist regime. Since the start of the recent war, too, four out of five of the UNSC resolutions have been vetoed by the US, Britain, and France. After 40 days, the fifth resolution was passed, which the US voted neutral to it. Although the UN General Assembly and the UNESCO are the bodies where these anti-Israeli resolutions have been ratified unanimously, it is the UNSC, which is the executive body for these resolutions. The only resolution which was ratified without condemning Israel for its crimes in Gaza has just asked for temporary ceasefires for humanitarian aids. The U.S. wielding of the veto power has both discredited the UNSC and given the green light to the Zionist terrorist army to continue the mass murdering and genocide of civilians in Gaza and the West Bank. Another measure that the United States took to support the Israeli crimes was to threaten the Arab and Islamic countries to avoid any move against the Zionist regime. The U.S. officials have traveled to West Asia and met with regional officials several times since October 7th. These trips have been focused on refraining from any measures whatsoever against Israel. The leader of the Yemeni Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, said in this regard, Americans have pressured the Arab and Islamic countries to avoid any practical assistance to the people of Gaza. Meanwhile, Americans have sent warships and fighters to the region to prove they will throw their support for the fake Zionist regime in case of any threat. Although most of the Arab and Islamic states have shown for the past decades that they would not take any tangible measure against Israel, the U.S. recent pressures have intimidated them further. The U.S. and European performance in the face of the tragedy in Gaza revealed the nasty reality of the Western communities and proved the mendacity of their claims on rights and freedom. Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Alavi Tehrani. Please stay tuned. Thank you.
نسبت به اهل بیت، نسبت به امامت که مهمترین موضوع دین.
We as Muslims must observe five important etiquettes regarding the status of imamat of the Ahlul Bayt. These five etiquettes are love for Ahlul Bayt, obedience towards Ahlul Bayt, true recognition of the status of Ahlul Bayt, and finally, believing in their guardianship. These etiquettes not only must be observed, but also they must be practiced.
اولین وادیش وادی محبت. و همین وادی محبت.
The most important etiquette that must be observed regarding Ahlul Bayt is love for them. This is so important that without love for Ahlul Bayt, our other obligatory acts like Salat, Saum, and Hajj might not be accepted. In other words, doing our obligations without loving the Ahlul Bayt makes our faith incomplete. True love for Ahlul Bayt means to love them in heart and words, and to always remember them and their conduct. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Alavi Tehrani. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
An-naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-hadi means the guide. All the imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdi'a al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malaa.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam, the 10th divinely appointed Imam, the 10th divinely appointed successor and trustee to the final messenger of Allah, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. He was the esteemed son of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam, and he was the grandson of His Eminence, the 8th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the financial epicenter of the Shias. Many countless Muslims paid their allegiance to Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, and so he received many legal dues and monies from across the Muslim world, and then he distributed these in a just, fair, and Islamic manner. But on the other hand, the Abbasid caliphs of his era exploited the economy of the Muslim Ummah to satisfy their carnal pleasures. They spent the wealth of Muslims wastefully upon singers and dalliers. The red nights of the Abbasid caliphs in Baghdad and Samarra were full of all things that Allah prohibited, and these Abbasid caliphs absolutely turned their backs to the Islamic principles and indulged in haram pleasures and lusts. And it was against all this that, as a beacon of light, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam stood up against the darkness promoted by the Abbasid caliphs.
Parts of Ziyara text of Jamaatul Kabira issued by Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. As-salamu ala a'immatil huda wa masabih at-tuja wa a'lam at-tuqa wa dawin nuha.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thoughts, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call, and the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.